I shall read from our lesson from the Gospel according to St. Luke, the 23rd chapter, beginning with the 33rd verse. It is a part of the story of the crucifixion. And when they were come to the place which is called Calvary, there they crucified him, and the malefactors, one on the right hand, and the other on the left. Then said Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And they parted his raiment and cast lots. And the people stood beholding. And the rulers also with them derided him, saying, He saved others. Let him save himself, if he be Christ, the chosen of God. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming to him and offering him vinegar and saying, If thou be the king of the Jews, save thyself. And a superscription also was written over him in letters of Greek and Latin and Hebrew. This is the king of the Jews. And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, If thou be Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, Dost not thou fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, Verily I say unto you, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. This passage has frequently been used in the course of Christian history to indicate that theology is really not at all necessary. How much theology did the penitent thief have? He didn't know anything about transubstantiation, consubstantiation, the ubiquity of Christ's body, the difference between the procreation of the Son and the procession of the Holy Ghost. And for that matter, he knew nothing about the sacraments. He had not been baptized. He'd never had the Lord's Supper. But Christ said, This day thou shalt be with me in paradise. How little theology it takes to get to heaven. This has been the conclusion more than once of groups in Christian history who have derided theological speculation and sometimes considered it even dangerous. They said it's not necessary for salvation. It's not even necessary for goodness. I remember that when I was in college, I was corresponding with my sister and propounded to her some theological question, and she replied, Do you have to straighten this out to be good? And sometimes we have suspected that perhaps theology is dangerous. My father was a pastor in Colfax, Washington for 18 years. Most of the other ministers were fundamentalist. By them, at any rate, he was accounted a liberal. In the summertime, during his vacation, he always went to hear them preach. And after the death of my mother, my sister accompanied him. On one such occasion, when he came in, the minister immediately pitched into a denunciation of my father's theology. And at the end of the service, asked him to give the benediction. He arose and invoked the peace of God, which passes understanding. As my sister walked home with him, she said, Father, your tolerance exceeds understanding. He said, Hilda, I have learned that men are better than their theologies. So here is the feeling that it isn't necessary to have a theology for salvation. It isn't necessary for goodness, and it may even do harm. And consequently, there are those who have derided all speculation and analysis of opinions about God, about Christ. They say religion is very simple and you don't need all of this. But Jesus himself did not take that attitude. When he was asked about the greatest commandment, he said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind." He was quoting the Old Testament, but he added to it, "and thy mind" is not in the Old Testament quotation. "And with all thy mind." And if we do not use our minds, we may accept any sort of a religion, any sort of a fad or a craze, and say, "Well, makes me feel good, isn't that all right? What's it matter?" We become indifferent to truth, and we may fall a prey to superstitions. Some time ago, I was staying in a hotel. I came in for breakfast. The man was sitting there by himself. I said, "May I join you?" He said, "Yes, indeed." It turned out that he was a highly intelligent, thoroughly efficient young businessman who was an executive of a firm for manufacturing prefabricated houses for putting up rapidly an urban development. A keen mind. And then he wanted to know what I was, and I told him I was in the field of religion. "Oh," he said, "I don't go for any of those superstitions." So we talked on a while. He said, "What do you think of astrology?" He said, "When were you born?" I said, "In March." He said, "The first of the month or the end of the month?" I said, "The end of the month." He said, "Just the same as my wife, and I can tell you your disposition exactly." I don't know whether he inferred it from that of his wife. When we got up to go, we got into the elevator, and he said, "What floor?" I said, "Well, since you know my horoscope, you ought to tell me." He said, "All right, you win." Well, here was a man who was genuinely keen in the whole business area and yet fell for what is a most unfounded superstition. It goes back to the time of the Babylonians. It never has contributed any significant information about the future or about a disposition. The classic refutation is the case of twins who are born under the same star and yet turn out very differently. Luther had no use for it. He said, "Look at me. I was a miner's son. I went to the university. I became a monk. And then I gave up monasticism and married a nun. And how could the stars see that?" Luther said, "Any peasant will carefully examine a horse before he'll buy it, but he'll swallow anything on religion." And it was said of Charles II that he'd believe anything if it wasn't in the Bible. And then take our friends, the Mormons. There are very fine people among them. I have high regard for the discipline of their young people. They have very fine intellect. Some of the men on the faculty at the University of Utah do admirable work in their disciplines. And yet most of them apparently swallow the Book of Mormon. Allegedly, it was given on golden plates by the angel Moroni to Joseph Smith, and then the plates very conveniently disappeared so nobody could check up on them. But recently, they were supposed to be given in Egyptian hieroglyphics. Recently, a fragment of some Egyptian hieroglyphic, I think, has been found at the Metropolitan Museum, and it's been proved that it belonged to Joseph Smith, and that gave him the idea. And then he fabricates the whole story of an emigration from Palestine to the New World, and then has a lot of ramblings around written in the an imitation of the style of the King James. It's simply romance. Very dangerous romance, too, because it's inimical to equality in race relations. Now, I have one Mormon friend, a librarian, who tells me, frankly, he doesn't believe it. But apparently a great many of them do, because I made the mistake in the book of saying that the Mormons were the 10 tribes. And I got vehement protest and was told to look at the Book of Mormon and see that I must get this straightened out. A great many of them of high intelligence and integrity are willing to believe that book. Then take our friends, the Seventh-day Adventists. They're most admirable people. I have lectured in one of their seminaries. I lectured in their school in Beirut. I have for them very high regard, but I can't share their views that many entertain with regard to the possibility of determining the return of the Lord. One of their historians, and a very good historian, was taking me through their library, and he showed me a periodical which ceased publication in 1948 because the editor believed that Christ would come the next year. He said, "Isn't that funny? They had the wrong scheme of calculation." Well, when intelligent people can believe such things, I begin to be skeptical about myself. Wonder what superstition I've got. There's need to use our minds to critically examine and rightly divide the word of truth. Even the very life of Jesus must be examined on historical grounds. Faith is not believing what you know ain't so. We've got to check critically, and we've not been given our intelligence for nothing. And theology is precisely that. It's applying intelligence and examination to our religious beliefs. At the same time, the point is valid. We are not to refuse, as some do, to believe anything which is incapable of laboratory verification. The deepest, the most profound truths and values are not subject to that kind of critical examination and verification. Take a sunset. We know it'll come again. We don't know when or in what manner. To be sure, of course, we can take photographs. We can study the prismatic distributions of light. We can study atmospheric conditions. But all that constitutes the glory of the sunset, the glow, the majesty, the power, the burst of light, oh, one can't pin that down. And if we will have none of it unless we can get it into a test tube, what wonderful values of life we have forfeited. And the same thing is true of the experiences of religion. They too are fluctuating. We can't call them up on command. Sometimes we may be lifted up to the third heaven and experience that which eye hath not seen and ear hath not heard, and neither hath it entered into the heart of man. And we can't say the next day that we'll bring it back again. For there are tides of the Spirit, and they are not at our command. But are we to say that they have no reality, no truth, no power, unless we can bring them down into our grasp and pull them apart with our analyses? Rather, we must in faith launch out upon the tides of the Spirit until they carry us out into the great deep. And although we are to examine with critical inquiry the documents of the history of our faith and the life of Jesus, we shall never understand him unless, with Mary in the garden, we are able to say, Rabboni. We shall rise and sing number 375.